treason, sedition, rebellion. This is the heritage of the American patriot. Those revolutionaries who stood on principle to fight against tyranny no matter the cost. And that spirit lives strong today in the activists and freedom fighters who fight against the authoritarian state. Each in their own way, each with their own mission, united for the cause of freedom.
I had the idea to run on a platform of fuck the police prior to actually winning the primary.
I mean, AOC is a drama queen and she's full of shit.
They said, you don't get to tell us no, we're the state health department, and I said, hell no.
You brought a freaking guillotine.
People already pushing back in ways that didn't even need any votes to be cast.
I'm not ratting on anybody, and I did what I did, so you're going to have to give me what the law says you have to give me.
You want to make the world a better place? Have some babies and raise them to not be stupid.
Hope I don't get canceled. Talk to you.
These are the people whose stories I'm here to share. I'm Justin O'Donnell, and this is Submersive.
Man, governments are not going to like this shit.
Ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, activists, anarchists, shit posters, and people of the internet, thanks for tuning in again. Episode 87 of Subversive. Tonight's going to be a good one. As always, I'm your host, Justin O'Donnell. And before we get started, just remember, whatever platform you're listening on, whether it's YouTube Live, Odyssey, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Anchor, or on the air on the radio at LRN.fm, make sure you can help out the channel grow and show by sharing with and liking and commenting on every platform. Now, if you enjoy the content, you can join the insurgency by visiting patreon.com/O'Donnell. Again, that's patreon.com/ODONNELL. And make sure to check out our sponsor, Snack Swag, for all your favorite Liberty merch and all your favorite libertarian merch, where you can literally wear your principles on your sleeve. Brand new designs for t-shirts, hoodies, coffee mugs, and more. And if you check it out today, limited time run, short time special, don't know how long they're going to be available, but you can get your great Tyler Hobbs 2024 merchandise available only at snackswag.com. And if you want to keep in touch between shows, follow me on social media and join our community Discord channel where you can chat with other fans and friends of the show at any time about the world of liberty and what's going on. And again, all those links can be found in the description of the video or podcast that you are listening to or watching. And now, the special news. Recently, we're also working on filming a brand new documentary film, Live Free and Thrive, 101 Reasons Why Liberty Lives in New Hampshire, and so should you, being put together to complement a book that I'm publishing in a couple of weeks. You know, we are crowdfunding for the effort right now. We've been up for about a week, and as you can tell, it's been off to a great start already. About $7,500 raised to help get this documentary off the ground, running and rolling. We have professional crews, cameraman, equipment. It's going to be something great. We're planning and hoping to have everything done to debut at Liberty Forum in March. So go over, check it out. The link in the description. Again, it's gofundme.com/101reasons. You can learn all about the product and the project and how you can help out today. Now, it's election season, folks. And that means there's some people out there who've decided that their mental health matters a hell of a lot less than fighting for what they believe in. And some of them have actually stepped up to run for office. Now, you watch wild, you know that I've done it before. That's how we got our start. I've run for Congress. I've run for Senate, statewide and locally. I've managed campaigns at the local level. I'm managing a federal campaign right now. It is not something easy. It's not something anyone should take lightly. It's one hell of a drain on your mental and physical health, and it wears you down. You lose all sorts of semblance of free time. It strains relationships and generally hurts your career in ways that take years, if not decades, to recover from. But still, people do it every 2 years. In some states, every year. Why? Why do people take the step up to do something like that? Now, in a return to tradition, if we look back to the roots of the show, we got started here highlighting candidates, people running for office, and what made them special and what they thought they could bring to the race. And we want to kind of return to that every year for election season. And regardless of chances of winning, to give somebody an opportunity to express what really matters to them and what made them try to run. And tonight, joining me all the way from the Pennsylvania, the Libertarian Party's candidate for governor of the Keystone State, we got Matt Hackenberg. Matt, thanks for joining tonight. How are you?
Great. How are you doing?
Oh, I'm doing great. But I mean, I have to start off. I have to ask everybody why. Why run for office? I mean, of all the things you can do to help liberty in your lifetime and make a difference, why choose politics?
Well, I hate myself and I like punishing myself. So that's
Sounds like a wicked libertarian thing to say, I guess. but no, it's running for office. It is a strain. It's a pain in the ass. Like, how long have you been doing it? I know I try and tell people based on my own experience, if you're going to run for office, especially a statewide office, you have to start as soon as the last election ended.
Yeah, honestly, save a year ago, less than a year ago, I never would have considered ever running for any office, much less governor. So it's something that kind of fell in my lap and an opportunity. I figured it was my calling and my duty to take it. So
is it more of a duty than a calling?
Yeah, you know, but kind of a calling, kind of a duty, you know, a little bit of both. Depending on what it is.
If nobody does it, then who? Like, the big question that always comes when, like, if not me, then who? If not now, then when? Like, if you truly believe in something and you truly believe that nobody currently running for the position accurately represents your views and your values, then if you can't recruit somebody else to step up and take the risk, then I guess it's on you.
Yeah. And that's what it goes down to. I mean, that there's who else is willing to do it? Who else has the ideas and the principles to do it correctly? And I was just, you know, well, I'll do it. I'll take the sacrifice.
Now, did you face any kind of, has it always been you, the candidate, or did you run against somebody for the nomination? Like, what's the background here? Like, I don't actually even know if Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania has ballot access. I'm going to be honest, outside of New Hampshire and the Region 8 states that I represented when I was on the LNC, I actually pay very little attention these days to the rest of the country and kind of like it that way. And I like that people in Pennsylvania are focused on Pennsylvania because that's what matters most, and as much as I'm focused on New Hampshire. But, like, how did you end up being the candidate for governor?
So we are a minor party. We have minor party access or minor party status. So they get some extra privileges in terms of ballot access. I am going to be on the ballot across the state, as well as quite a few of our other candidates. You know, we do need to do the whole petition drive and everything else. So that's an effort. But I believe this year we broke state records, or at least you know, came close to the record for quite some time in terms of the number of candidates we've gotten on the ballot, statewide and local positions.
Now, I think I saw something like, do Republicans and Democrats also have to petition in Pennsylvania? Is it separate rules, separate amounts, different petition requirements?
It's totally different. Like, for example, I think they had to petition, you know, much earlier in the year. And then they also, I think they can only petition, you know, registered Republicans or Democrats, the people of their party, whereas we can petition to anyone.
Well, I mean, it's not like it's a small pool of registered Republicans and Democrats compared to registered Libertarians to pick from. Yeah. I know Massachusetts has similar rules to that, where every party has to petition. Republicans, Democrats, and Libertarians all have to petition the same. And it turns into a real burden, because when Libertarians have ballot access, because Massachusetts has minor and major parties. Yeah. And when they're a minor party, they can petition from anyone in the state. When they're a major party, they can only petition from Libertarians and Independents. So it actually ends up a lot harder to get on the ballot when you have major party status than minor party status in Massachusetts. So it's a little catch-22. Do we want to do well, or do we want to have an easy time going about it?
Right. It's actually, I mean, the whole petitioning thing is a little more than just a cost of entry. So the major parties, Republicans, Democrats, mm-hmm. they can just be petitioners, and it's no big deal. It's easy for them. You know, for Libertarians, we didn't hire any petitioners this year. We did it all just with volunteers.
Sure. I mean, you say that, but here in New Hampshire, we had two different slates of candidates running for trying to get on the ballot as Libertarians here in New Hampshire. And one group, the group I helped manage for Jeremy Kaufman's campaign, was an almost entirely volunteer effort. We had dedicated volunteers out every single weekend all summer. We needed 3,000 signatures. We got 6,000. The other group was an entirely paid effort. Mercenaries from all over the country came to get them on the ballot. And one of their candidates ended up getting disqualified, and one of their candidates only made it by a couple signatures.
Yeah, I mean, volunteer petitions are always going to be higher quality than
sure,
you know, for politicians. And we've always had issues in the past with paid petitioners where a higher rate would be, signatures would be rejected.
I know. Even one of my volunteers, somebody who helped work on Jeremy Kaufman's campaign here in New Hampshire, has in the past been a paid professional petitioner, and he helped volunteer and work for us. And when the Nick Sarwark's organization contacted him and asked if he wanted to be paid, he gave him a price like, sure, like $12 a signature. and they ended up not hiring him.
Yeah. But so, you know, for us, then that's one thing. But the you know, Republicans and Democrats, they have whole organizations and systems in place. They can pay people to go do this en masse and painless. Or even for us, if we're paying for it, it's tricky. We don't have that kind of money to do it. So it's like anything else, like you know, corporate regulations. It's just a barrier. It's just to price out the little guy.
Sure. A lot of people don't realize that about corporate regulations. That some of the biggest lobbyists and drafters of corporate regulations are Walmart and like IBM and big major corporations that draft the regulations to put their competition out of business.
For your safety. It's for your safety. Think of the children.
For your safety, for the cleanliness and the ease of readability of the ballot, you got to keep everyone off the line. Now, I do know there's been a lot of drama this year within the Libertarian Party of Pennsylvania, is schismed into two parties. One's calling itself Keystone now. One's calling still the Libertarian Party. Does the Keystone candidates have a candidate on the ballot? Or
I mean, I wouldn't say it's schism. A few members left the party and started their own party.
Sure.
The Libertarian Party is doing great. I don't know anything about the Keystone Party, to be honest.
It's a great thing to know. Nothing.
Yeah.
It means your focus is in the right spot. Right. So, I know that's fantastic. You're right. Even if it's just a few members leaving the party, though, not really a schism. I mean, that really is a schism. A few members in such a small group. We struggled to retain membership year over year in the Libertarian Party and Libertarian movements. Like, how can we afford to be campaigning when we can't even retain the members that we have?
I mean, I would say, though, so like I said, this year we've gotten more people on the ballot than ever before with all volunteer petitioners. And even though we lost a handful of people, the people we lost were more of a attraction than anything else. They're largely toxic and harmful to the morale of the party. So without them, we've had more engagement. We have more involvement. The people are more motivated. So really, it's a net benefit. Sometimes if people are dead weight, they're dead weight, and let them go.
Awesome. Now, Benzo does have a question, and Benzo Barbie in the chat is like jumping ahead, but kind of right on pace. Like, debates, and I've been having this discussion. I just published an article here in New Hampshire as an op-ed in one of our papers, and wrote a press release for Jeremy Kaufman's campaign about debate access. It's something that, like, it's really the Libertarians' place to shine. There's a lot of debate internally with people like myself about whether or not performance in the debate actually affects the outcome of an election, or if it's just a joint marketing opportunity to reinforce your own base, and given the way the debates are structured and presented to each other. But have you been invited to any debates, or are there any debates happening?
Not any major debates or debates of significance. I mean, really, if you think about it, like, what benefit would it provide, you know, one of the major party candidates to join a debate with me or anyone else? As far as I know, I don't think even the Republican and Democrat candidates are having a debate. And maybe they are, but I know they're dragging their feet. Josh Shapiro, the Democratic candidate, he did not want to debate at all. And if you think about it, what benefit do these guys have for debating?
I used to take the opportunity back when I was running for office to try and convince each of my major party opponents all the time that it suited them to have me in the debate to hurt the other one.
Yeah.
It never worked. The strategy never worked, but like I thought it had a chance. I'm like, approached a Democrat. I'm like, you should really demand I be in the debate so I can pull votes from the Republican. And at the same time, I'd be sending a text to the Republican's campaign manager. I'm like, you know, I pull from the left with my criminal justice reviews. Like, just trying to get them to be convinced that they both wanted me in the debate.
And then when they go play golf together later, they talk about it and laugh.
That's the problem, is we forget that they actually are on the same side the whole time, the majority of them. There are some other fringe third-party candidates out there that aren't on their side, but they're not necessarily on ours either. Now, I mean, so what are you doing to kind of like actually campaign, like spread the message? Because you've got unique ideas. You've got something that's not being represented in the campaign from the two major parties, something that's not being represented by the administration. Like, what are you actually bringing to the election that's different and unique? And like, how are you trying to get that to voters?
Well, I mean, that's really the hard thing. You know, when you're small third party, you know, getting your word out there is difficult. We try to think of any opportunity we can to get out and to talk, and kind of spread our ideas. We do interviews and discussions and go to events, and just try to get some excitement out there. I want to try to start getting out to colleges in the state and talk to kids. I mean, my goal here is to spread this message, right? I don't really believe I'll ever be elected, but these ideas need to be spread. And I think one thing I've been calling a lot of light to this past few weeks has been that while our two candidates are debating over abortion, the one says ban all abortion, and the other one calls an extremist for wanting to ban abortion. And my mind is like, guys, the people in our state, they're worried about being able to afford to heat their homes this winter, right?
I don't think that's unique to Pennsylvania, even anybody watching this nationally. I turn on Pandora just for my drive to work, and every other ad is Senator Maggie Hassan. My Republican opponent wants to ban abortions and tell women to get over it. Every single ad, it's just being hammered nonstop. Yeah. And you're right, it's a distraction, because I don't think, like, when we see the polls, it's not the number one issue people care about, but it's the number one issue being campaigned about. The issue people care about, at least here in New Hampshire, I don't know about you, is the fact that we're looking right to winter with record high fuel prices and oil prices.
The people are worried about, like, how are you gonna afford to heat your homes, drive to work, right? And now we have the brilliant United States leaders leading us right into World War III with Russia. And it's like, guys, you better be worrying about than whether you can kill your unborn child, right? I mean, I'm sorry, but what is a distraction? All these things are distractions.
Like, stances on abortion notwithstanding, like, I'm a pro-life, pro-choice individual. I support a woman's right to choose and an access to healthcare, but the constant badgering and the ads about it and the unrealistic and, like, the hyperbole behind the debate has made me hate most pro-choice candidates.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they're going to ban abortion. I'm like, you know what? I kind of hope they do. Just to shut you up, like, and get those people out of my state. Like, hopefully, no, but... especially in states like New Hampshire. Again, I don't know. We have a constitutional provision here in New Hampshire about a right to privacy. So like Roe v. Wade and Planned Parenthood v. Casey would basically hold up in court in New Hampshire, even if it doesn't federally, because we have that constitutional right that they pretended to find in the 14th Amendment. So it's a non-issue altogether in this state, yet it's still the primary focus of campaigns. And I feel like the Democrats just really, really, really want to keep hammering that, because it's drowning out anything the Republicans have to say.
Right. And what else do they have? They harp on this one issue, which is like, I think it affects most people, really. And
affect most people. And the thing that does affect most people is something that's complicated to understand. And unfortunately, this is one of the things that I think holds libertarians back, is the place where libertarians seem to shine and do the best. Mm-hmm. And when it comes to debate with Republicans and Democrats, is economic issues. But unfortunately, sometimes I feel like when a libertarian starts to explain economics to a normal person, they lose them the moment they enter a postgraduate level of discourse, which is almost necessary to understand what libertarians are talking about when it comes to fractional reserve banking and quantitative easing.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that's really a lot of libertarians don't understand is that you have to work hard to appeal to emotion, right? Most people are not these logical thinkers like we are. So you have to make things a more logical or emotional appeal. And that's it's harder to do as a libertarian.
If you're ever campaigning and find somebody who understands the logic of your arguments, move on, because they're already voting for you and you just didn't know it. But this is what I like to tell people. But so what are some of the top issues you're trying to campaign on and get people talking about?
So, like, one, the my personal passion is defend the guard, right? And you can say, one, under the United States Constitution, it defines that declaration of war has to be made by the act of Congress. And in my mind, that means as the governor, my duty would be to not send our National Guard troops into federal service unless there's a federal congressional declaration of war. And I think that should be further codified with legislation to, like, defend the guard. That's just like a personal passion of mine. Unfortunately, the foreign policy is not as exciting to most people. It should be. In my mind, there's no other issue more pressing. And as a governor, as a state, is little you can do, but control the National Guard is one of the few things you do have influence over.
And we've seen it kind of exercised before, I think. Like, people forget about this. Like, the governor, and like whether with or without Defend the Guard legislation, which I think is critically important. I'm helping to lobby for the bill here in New Hampshire with the same organization that's running it nationally. We have a few reps sponsoring it. I was hammering a state senator about it the other day. He'd never heard of it. And I'm like, what do you mean you've never heard of it? Like, sit down and shut up. But it's critically important. But even without that legislation, the governor still has the power to say no.
Yeah,
and say, no, you can't take my guard troops. And people don't realize, like, it's untested. In all reality, it's untested. But we've seen one instance, at least in the last few years, where a governor has said no, and rather than test it in court, the federal government moved on and found another state. And that was when the Oregon National Guard was about to be deployed to Texas to do border security, and the very leftist progressive governor said, I will not allow Donald Trump to deploy my National Guard. And rather than fight it in court, the Department of Defense is like, yeah, we'll find someone else.
Yeah, yeah, good. Yeah, and absolutely. I mean, it is, and it not only can they do it, it's really, it's their duty, right? It's like, you know, it should be a congressional order to do so. It can't just be the president calling up whatever they want.
Yeah, but I mean, the United States has only ever declared war 11 times for 5 different wars against 11 different enemies, and hasn't done it since 1942. But like, let's see, I'm 33. In my entire adult life, we've been at war.
Yeah,
my entire life. I could go back to Reagan was president when I was born. And I lived through, well, not Reagan, Bush. Jeez, I can't even keep dates straight. But like, I grew up with Clinton presidency, into a Bush presidency, into an Obama presidency, into a Trump presidency, now into a Biden presidency. And like, the level of conflict that we've been at in the 33 years of my life has only gotten worse and progressed.
Oh, yeah.
As we've gone on. And that's like a terrible realization. And the fact is, our National Guards are actually picking up the brunt of that combat force, like, and the combat burden. And
yeah,
it's disheartening.
At one point, I was in the New Jersey Army National Guard. At one point, we had units deploying every 3 years. And it's like, you tell these guys that, hey, you can sign up 1 week in a month, 2 weeks a year, you can go and serve your local community and get free college. And oh yeah, here's the rifle. Go to Afghanistan again.
Yep.
And it's like taking these guys away from their families, just destroying homes, and disgusting thing.
Yeah, there used to be a meme that would circle around my Army National Guard unit. Like every couple of weeks, it'd go around an email, and it was just a picture of a C-130 with Cartman painted in white on the side, and the thought bubble just said, 2 weeks a year, my ass.
Right.
So nobody gets what they sign up for, but hey, that's the bait and switch of military service, and that affects active duty too. It's not just National Guard. No joke, that Semper Fi, it's the Marine Corps motto, it means always faithful. And if you told people when they were enlisting in the Marine Corps that it only went one way and the government was going to ignore that promise for all of eternity and not take care of its veterans, and a lot of people wouldn't actually join the military. And at the same time, if the government was known for staying faithful to its promises, they might not need the Marine Corps. So, but hopefully that's what we can do with things like Defend the Guard, is keep a government accountable to holding its promises and not having that resource to just throw around like a blunt hammer.
Right. Yeah. And just sweeping around the rug with, like, you know, 22 daily suicides and whatever.
Yeah. Now I see on your website, I did look through your website, like, you also talk about like healthcare and housing and economy and children's programs, along with Defend the Guard and Second Amendment issues and typical libertarian economic talking points. But like, how do you stand out from like on things like economics from a conservative who is at least campaigning usually on the same issues, even if that's not what they do when they get in office?
Right. So, I mean, the economics thing is, it's difficult, obviously. You basically deregulate everything you can, stop enforcement on everything you can, try to reduce taxes as much as you can, eliminate taxes if you can. But, one thing I'm starting to talk about and push is that this inflation that we're seeing, inflation is caused by one thing and one thing only, and it's called the printing of money. And the Federal Reserve is doing this, and they're using it so the ruling elite can rob the rest of us. The only way out of that is through, abandoning the dollar, through a cryptocurrency or otherwise. So I think pushing this idea of, the state you know, with like taxes and Bitcoin, for example, start promoting the use of alternate currencies for a medium exchange would be fantastic. Only solution in my mind out of the whole dollar being destroyed.
So I'm terrified, I'm personally, of the idea of the state taking cryptocurrency and the state getting itself involved in cryptocurrency. And I say this as somebody who, like, cryptocurrency, it's not quite yet. There's been periods in my life where in the past few years where it's been the majority of every transaction I make in my daily living. I'm not quite at that point right now. It fluctuates with the economy and how I need things, but like where I can pay my rent in crypto, I can pay some of my bills, I shop with cryptocurrency, I buy my groceries with cryptocurrency. Like, I'm fortunate enough to be in a position in a geographic location where enough people have adopted cryptocurrency that I can use it on a daily basis. But to me, the terrifying fact of, like, once government gets its hands in something, then the government has a vested interest in maintaining its value and affecting and manipulating its value. And if people are paying taxes in crypto, the United States government has the ability to, like, absolutely monopolize market share of a lot of small cryptos and just flatten the price right before tax season and then hike it up afterwards when they're spending.
I mean, yeah, potentially. But you know, realize that if they don't have the ability to print dollars like they do now, then their ability to do a lot of things that they do now would be gone. So they would lose a lot of their economic powerhouse.
They could just mint a new coin.
No one takes it. I'm talking about things from the perspective of the state of Pennsylvania. You know, like I don't go to the feds. I see the feds as as almost like a foreign adversary. And
I guess the question comes to then, like, look at El Salvador. Everyone thought El Salvador was going to be the haven of cryptocurrency adoption because the president of El Salvador was all aboard Bitcoin. He wanted to accept Bitcoin, but then when, like, push comes to shove, at the end of the day, it turns out it was only Bitcoin. No other crypto is allowed. You had to use a custodial wallet that the state manages. You had to give your private keys to the state for every transaction is monitored. You have to use the Lightning Network, which is a third-party censorable network to verify transactions off-chain. And at any time, the government can freeze people's wallets and liquidate and seize their Bitcoin balances.
Well, obviously, I don't support the point is this, as a state, right, state of Pennsylvania, for example, you know, I think it's the governor's duty to defend the people of the state from the federal government and its encroachments. And one of the biggest of which is the Federal Reserve destroying our currency.
Sure.
I don't know a better way of doing that than through the use of
My recommendation personally, and I take this as a cryptocurrency stand. Like I said, I'm all in on the cryptocurrency thing, but I think when it comes to, like, what currencies a state should recognize and take, the state needs to, like, stick to the least volatile thing, the easiest to use thing, and, like, not infiltrate itself into a market, because cryptocurrency is a market and it's constantly fluctuating, changing, and competing, and those are things the state is incapable of innovating and competing. But if the state needs to function, and now I'm going to say abolish taxes, don't take taxes in crypto, just stop taxing people. If you find the need to have to tax somebody, why don't you have the state adopt as legal tender a truly inflation-proof and fluctuation-proof currency like gold and silver? They've been relatively stable in value for 1,000 years. An ounce of gold a few hundred years ago would get you a really nice suit of armor. Now it's roughly about $1,900, which will get you a really nice business suit. It's relatively the same value across 1,000 years that it's held for goods and services. 10 ounces of gold used to be able to get you a really nice horse. Now it gets you $19,000, might get you a decent car. Like, it's held its value there. But then there's things like gold backs, where you have spendable, tangible, non-fungible gold leaf, gold slips that people can spend in increments of a thousandth of an ounce of gold.
Yeah, I saw a few gold backs a while back. It's an impressive idea. I would argue, though, that the price of gold and silver is heavily manipulated by the banking system, by the federal government, and by other governments in the world. And much of the gold that's traded is paper, right? It doesn't actually exist, and who knows how much.
Sure. But they claim it's all auditable. And now, granted, I've had friends who've tried to order 100 ounces of silver and get delivery and all of a sudden run into problems.
Right.
But, like, It's even with all the manipulation they've had, it's maintained stability.
Yeah.
Even across that. So you can argue that there are some externalities in gold and silver where it might fluctuate a bit here and there. But if you got rid of the banking system altogether, I'd be willing to bet that it would still maintain its value, even not in value of US dollars, because that's going to fluctuate wildly, but in terms of like how much an ounce of gold actually gets you in goods and services.
Yeah. I mean, all I really care about, to be honest, is to be away from a fiat currency. That's all I want.
Sure. Absolutely.
It's hard money in my mind. I think cryptocurrency is a better solution, but we can go into, don't even go into all that.
one of the big things, I know you tweeted about this yesterday, and it's been one of our passion projects here in New Hampshire, at least with the First Day Project, is school choice and like education freedom. Yeah. And like we look at the culture war, and I hate using the word culture war, but there's really no other way to describe it, because it's not a left-right political battle anymore. It's an authoritarian versus anti-authoritarian culture war. From a top-bottom fight. And the first battleground is our public schools, where they have a monopoly on indoctrination of children, and they're basically grooming the next generation of activists against freedom 8 hours a day, 280 days a year in most cases, away from their parents, and their parents have no say over the matter.
Yeah, yep. Next to the defend the guard thing, the school is my next biggest issue. And it goes back and forth depending on the day of the week, which is more important to me. But yeah, the condition of our children is horrendous. And in many ways, two things tie in, because one of the reasons why you turn 18 and you want to go and defend your country is because of the indoctrination you got. And
sure.
13 years of public indoctrination. And I think now is the time is ripe, especially for going from school choice, because everyone got to see, or parents got to see, how horrendous the school system is with the COVID pandemic and the government's response to it. They got to see firsthand how their teacher unions do not care about their children. Schools do not care about their children. And is anyone who's a parent, is just like, this is a level of your evolutionary psychology. It puts you in a level of protection and just psychopathy. Not really psychopathy, but more just like a deep concern for your child. And like almost like nothing else matters more. So when you see this, it's like, this is a topic that resonates with a lot of parents. Right, left doesn't matter. I mean, I've talked to people on the left who are really upset about the mask thing, and they were very, very, very active about it. So you see your kid being harmed, your revolutionary brain kicks in, your laser brain kicks in and tells you something. So
now, do you know any of the statistics in Pennsylvania about like homeschooling rates or public school enrollment rates over the past few years? Because I know this has been one of the interesting things I've seen, not just here in New Hampshire. I know Arizona, it was a very big deal too. And Arizona has leaped from like the 19th best in school choice to the best in school choice in a matter of a few years because of how people reacted to COVID. In New Hampshire, we had a huge spike in our school freedom laws when our legislature reacted to how people reacted to COVID. I know the number of homeschooled children has doubled in New Hampshire in the past 3 years. Our public school enrollment has dropped by a significant percentage for the first time in history, where parents are pulling their kids out of public school in mass and sending them to private schools, to charter schools, homeschooling them, doing prendipods and stuff like that, in a response to how the public schools were run during COVID. And it was almost like government locks down, send the kids home, and they forced every parent in this country overnight to become a homeschooler. And a whole bunch of them realized, oh, this isn't that bad.
Right. And the things you're doing to your children is horrible.
Right. And all of a sudden, at the same time, while the kids were plopped in front of their laptops listening to their school lectures, for the first time in history, parents were hearing what was being said in the classroom.
Yeah, right. Yeah, it's terrible. I don't know the exact numbers in Pennsylvania, but we've already had an online charter school that was available as an option to most kids or all kids. So I don't know how much that's grown in size. Public or homeschooling is a challenge here. They have some ridiculous restrictions on it, but I do know that the enrollment in the schools have just dropped, and people have grown more to online charter schools and homeschools, which is great. And one thing I talk about a lot in my campaign is this need to focus on community. And you know, a lot of them talking about culture war. A big part of that is getting to more connection with our local people, the people we're around, the people we deal with, and work on community. And part of that community is that we should be working on, you know, homeschooling as part of as a community, whether it be, you know, people on your block, the people in your area, your friends, your family, and kind of make it more of a, you know, more of a traditional connected experience. Not this idea where your kid is thrown into a room with a bunch of people of the same exact same age from you know, a certain area, and that some of them get along with, some they don't get along with. And it just, I think it's an important focus. It needs to be an important focus of going forward. I said, not just for education, but for the entire, yes, with this idea of the culture war that, you know, we need to huddle in and focus on, you know, in our own communities.
Yeah. And a lot of people like can really undervalue the strength that community can have when it comes to education. Like, what's the, like, let's look back as far as we want. What's the origin of schools? And the origin of schools is people in farming communities and agrarian communities coming together and saying, okay, somebody has to educate the kids, but we got to get the crop in. So we can't all be babysitting our kids and teaching them all day while we're trying to get the crop in. You take this day, you take that day, you take that day. And eventually he said, well, you're really good at this. You just do this full time and we'll give you a portion of our food. And then taxes and then government regulative, but it all came back to community at the beginning. And we have an opportunity to kind of get back to that, the roots of education being in the family and in the community with things like these prendapods, yep, which are encouraging people to get together and rotate through teachers, through parents cooperatively teaching a pod of children, instead of just one parent teaching their children. And yep, like you have on these online curriculums, like you have your online charter school in Pennsylvania, but a lot of libertarians across the country use the Ron Paul curriculum, which is not expensive. And it's like, it's a lot less than your, what's being paid to put your kids in public school for sure. Yep. And then there's things like even the Khan Academy, which offers kindergarten through like a bachelor's degree for free.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
So, and you can get all of that right online. And I mean, let's face it. I think maybe some people might be afraid. Well, we can't just let kids get educated online. Your kids are learning more online on their cell phones and iPods than they are in school.
And here's the thing about learning education is that you really can't force someone to learn something they're not interested in. So taking kids, putting them in a classroom for so many hours a day, stare at the board while someone talks at them, isn't going to teach them anything. You know, try to pump them up with with amphetamines and hope for the best. In reality, when you can get them to read and memorize things, they can regurgitate it to it for a test, they don't actually learn. You know, learning happens as your interest, you know, drives you, as your need drives
you. Or it should, or as your completion drives you. Like, I think one of the biggest fundamental issues with education in this country, because we've really seen a steep and stark decline in education over the past six to eight years in this country, where like the quality of education, or at least the public perception of it, is dramatically decreased. Like, I remember, I wasn't even in school that long ago. I graduated high school in 2008 and I had a top-notch education. Like, I was prepared and like taught things, and I progressed, and I was allowed to progress ahead of my peers. And I think that's one of the things, is the No Child Left Behind Act, under the George Bush presidency. This is a Republican problem, not just a Democrat problem too. The No Child Left Behind Act also prohibited letting children go ahead of their peers. And so like, you're retaining kids. And like, people talk about how all kids care about these days are video games. And I think like, the kids who are hyper focused on video games are the ones you need to pay the most attention to as far as giving opportunities to. Because what makes a video game different than education nowadays is the kid, if they're stuck on a level in a video game, they're going to pour their heart and soul into beating that level so they can advance to the next one. And they're driven by the idea of advancement and progression and finishing a task. If we could like gamify education to the point where, like, instead of having a structured curriculum and a calendar where you let kids progress, and if they start moving ahead and they start excelling, you just keep moving them ahead and keep them excelling to beat the game, you might find those kids who are really, really damn motivated to graduate high school at 14 and be the next Elon Musk.
Right. Well, and two, I mean, the greater issue is that we have a society or culture has gone to the point where, you know, the only exposure kids have to, you know, challenges that interest them are video games. It's like,
right,
there's so many other things in the world they can go out and they can do that are interesting and challenging that they can go and accomplish and learn, instead of, you know, getting this idea in their mind that learning is sitting in a classroom and getting talked at for hours a day.
Sure. If they want to play video games for 3 hours a day, well, if that video game is educational in nature and they're learning more by playing that game than they would in school, You can kill two birds with one stone there. Give them something to learn. Give them something to do. And then still have time in your day to teach them other things. Like, you know, mow the damn lawn. Feed the chickens. Milk the cow. Like, let's mend this fence. Like, solar panels short-circuited. Let's learn some electrical engineering today.
Right.
Like, real life skills matter a hell of a lot more to kids than what they're learning in the classroom. And everything they're learning in a classroom can be taught with a video game or something innovative method.
Yeah. I mean, not just kids, but, you know, your entire life. You know, you learn better through doing than from sitting in a room getting talked at. You know?
Absolutely. You just can't tweet about it or else LPNH is going to tick off Gary Johnson and everyone in the world. No, but it's fun. We actually, now, how are you campaigning on all these issues, like as a form of like radicalism? Because like it sounds like you have really great ideas and you're posing them in a way to like normal people can understand them, but like if you get any pushback, like do you have a defense? Like, you talk about school reform, have you ever talked about abolishing public schools and just letting the market figure it out, or is it let's not scare people kind of a thing?
I mean, I'll go there depending on, you know, if I'm prodded on it. I mean, like I'm not shy about pointing out that I think taxation is theft, and I think the state should have no involvement in any of these things at all. You know, and that a lot of these suggestions I make are meant to just be incremental, meant to be bite-sized pieces. You know, I mean, I'm an anarchist, and I have no problem pointing that out. I don't normally, you know, come out with it for more of a mainstream, reporter or something. But yeah, I mean, I have no problem being quite radical. You know, when I talk about the ATF, you know, I'll call the ATF a terrorist organization.
That's not radical.
Yeah, no. I mean, there's Republicans will agree with you on that one. So it just the balls to say it. So yeah, it's I don't usually go into depth. Most people don't think that much into depth about these things. So which is fine.
Is that a problem? Maybe the problem with society is that people aren't thinking in depth about things. Like, hey, the actual problem with schools is that they fucking exist. It's not that the problem isn't the purple haired teacher trying to brainwash the children into being transgender. The problem is that the state has declared that you don't have the right to educate and inform your children and that they have to do it.
Right. That's a big part of the argument I make is that, look, we're not going to be able to regulate CRT or any of these other things out of existence. No amount of laws are going to fix these problems. You know, these laws are only going to be fixed by, you know, getting your kids out of public schools and the choice to do that. Now, I'll make the point too that, like, look, if you give parents a choice between your education providers and you allow a market, market competition, public school system will be out of business, right? They won't be able to operate, won't be able to function because they're trash. They're absolute trash. They haven't innovated. They haven't done anything in ever. And we can't imagine it now because we've all only seen this old Prussian model education. That's all we know. It's all we think about. But if we allow there to be competition, innovation in education, we'd quickly get left in the dust and it would be seen as a joke.
Yeah, no, Gary Johnson, I feel, was almost half the way there in 2016 when he ran for president, when talking about school choice, when he said abolish the federal Department of Education and leave it to the states. He says 50 laboratories of innovation is the best competition you can have in determining how to run education. And I think he's halfway there because, like, he's right. Innovation and competition is absolutely the best way to do it, but we shouldn't stop at 50 when we have 120 million households in this country.
Right, right.
Like, there's no way 50 methods will be satisfactory to meet the needs and demands of 120 million unique individuals.
I mean, really, I mean, the only person people should have any say over a child's education are the parents, and no one else have any input. And that's, I think,
the only monopoly I agree with.
Yeah, right. And like, ideally, don't take money from them at all for education. And if you are, then at least give them the opportunity of how that money is spent.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, what is it you actually see your role is? Because again, like, you you, in theory, always have the opportunity to run as a Republican or Democrat. And you don't have to change your views, change your opinions, change your stances. You can run on a ticket because everyone knows, even the most diehard Republican and Democrat knows the party means nothing at the end of the day. And you can campaign on these issues. And even if you know you're not going to win, you might get a bigger platform in their kind of primary caucus or their primary election to have your views heard by normal people than you would as a libertarian candidate and a third party candidate with a lot less of the struggle, strife, and fight to get it done. Like, so what is it that made you want to do so as a libertarian? And what do you see the role of the Libertarian Party in politics moving forward to be?
Well, so my interest in politics is pretty much limited to only the Libertarian Party. I have no interest in working with other parties, at least not in any major way. My Libertarian Party is limited to that of the Mises takeover. If the liberty movement culture was brought to the party and made this party one that in line with my belief, my values, is why I'm here. I'm here for the community, really, of the party and the activists working towards an end, working towards some goal. And it's been fantastic as far as that goes. If you're while I'm here, I might as well take the opportunity and spread the message by running for governor. None of these things would really serve well with running as Republican or Democrat, even as a primary, because I do this because I want to be, with supporting a group of people who have the right values. I want my name to be attached to a label that actually means something and isn't nebulous as Republican or Democrat.
Sure, that's fair enough. I mean, I come from a little bit different perspective, and it's weird and kind of on a surface level kind of hypocritical of me, whereas like I do work within the Libertarian Party, I support the Libertarian Party, but at the same time, I'm a huge advocate for the free state strategy and the run to win strategy rather than to run to lose strategy that we have here in New Hampshire, where we have done so well at infiltrating the major parties here in New Hampshire with libertarian ideas that I can go to any house session in Concord at our state capitol. And if I just sit there and listen, not paying attention, at some point I'll hear a state rep at the pulpit going on a rant unrelated to the bill being debated about how taxation is theft. That happens every single bill that comes up. Like one of the state reps will get up and just make that rant. The Republican Party adopted taxation as theft as its slogan and printed merchandise and campaigned on it.
So I agree with you there. New Hampshire is a unique case where there's actually some value in it. And unlike Pennsylvania, the Republican Party is. I mean, I'm interested in getting involvement. Worked with a little bit with like Tea Party groups and things like that.
Sure.
Even they aren't necessarily dedicated Republicans.
Sure, so. but. Being undedicated Republicans, do you have an opportunity to kind of, Barbie points it out, shift that Overton window with them, bring them a little bit more to the extreme side and create a more extreme element within the Republican Party that can like take the opportunity of the platform they have to actually push libertarian ideas? Is that something even feasible in Pennsylvania? Because I know Pennsylvania is very similar to New Hampshire in one case where you have so many elected officials that are running on partisan lines that, like, I mean, your dog catchers and like mosquito water commissions are partisan, aren't they? That's how we managed to do it in New Hampshire, is just because we have such a big state house that the major parties can't fill their ranks. So we just, we'll run for it. And we're going to put that R next to our name and we're going to scream the most radical libertarian stuff you've ever heard until it becomes policy.
That's great. That's great. So New Hampshire is a prime example of when community happens.
True, absolutely true. The fact that New Hampshire has the highest membership in the Libertarian Party per capita in the entire country, and it's not close between Alaska at second place, is not an accident. And the Free State Project has done a phenomenal thing in identifying libertarians, getting motivated people here to New Hampshire to actually like. Fight the fight instead of just tweet about it. And I think that's something that the libertarian movement as a whole really needs to pick up. It's actually one of my big criticisms, even of the Mises caucus takeover, is there have been some instances across the country where Mises caucus people have taken over, picked it up, started the fight. And there's been a lot of instances where they haven't realized the Libertarian Party and the Liberty Movement was anything more than a Twitter handle.
Right.
So, and that's why I question the role of the Libertarian Party moving forward, because when so much time, energy, and effort is spent like fighting over marketing and messaging, and then they can't even do that right once they do take over, at what point is what we're fighting for a lost brand? And then we'd be better off just like taking an opportunity, running for state rep as a Democrat, not opening our mouths, winning an election by accident, and then actually voting for liberty to happen.
See, I mean, I'm of the opinion that like electoral politics is really not a solution in any way.
No, especially not democracy, because democracy is terrible.
Even if you can get a few, if you know, a large scale, even if you get a few libertarians or secret libertarians, you know, Republicans and Democrats, that's not going to make any major institutional changes. The only way to get through changes is through societal and cultural changes. And where I see the real value for me personally, Libertarian Party, is it's just a community of people who you get together with and you work towards a goal. And you develop this, this brotherhood with these other people who you're fighting towards something that's a challenge, and you all have similar ideas and similar thoughts. And that alone is well worth it in my mind. Even though the party gets nowhere else, there's no political advantage. The fact that there's a group of people who now have worked together and who now operate together and think together is beautiful. It's amazing. And it's powerful. And as far as the greater liberty movement goes, it's basically just grows and strengthens the liberty movement and lets us carry on these ideas and push them forward. And
I hate to act like the evangelist here, but you're making a great case for concentration with the Free State Project. and that really is the case. And that's one of my selling points for the Free State Project with the other work I do. And my new book that I wrote is the case for concentration really is the only path forward. I believe the path forward to winning liberty is in culture and community and localization. Mm-hmm. And you're right, electoral politics, like we're just a fringe of electoral politics. We're a minority. So if we're never going to have that difference, like building a community of people you trust and can work with is great, and having people you can rely on is great. But if that community is constantly threatened with oppression by the state and the institutions you live under and need to survive, like it'll eventually have enough stressors to make it break if you are in fact the minority. And so like, how do you overcome that with the approach of community other than everyone packing your bags, moving to New Hampshire? We got homesteads, we got cities, we got small towns, walkable downtowns, a seaport and an airport, and like joining a community that is not the minority, because as long as you're in a minority, democracy will oppress you.
I mean, I would argue that Pennsylvania is the home of the most based anarchist group in the country, the Amish, who don't fly and don't pay taxes.
With permission from the government that can be revoked at any time.
Permission came after the fact. They refused to cooperate. And not a good look to go and round up a bunch of peaceful Christians and throw them in cages. So the government's like, oh, yeah, sure, here's permission. But the reality is they don't tax them because they refuse.
Sure.
For anything to do with religious freedom or anything like that. But my wife and I were planning on moving to New Hampshire or considering moving to New Hampshire before joining the LPPA. And we did. We met a lot of great people, and it's amazing. And anyone who's listening and doesn't know any good libertarians in person, only knows people online, I highly recommend just joining the party, joining anything to get involved, because it's very freeing. It's this amazing feeling being around people regularly who think like you and have these similar ideas, and you don't have to explain the most basic economics to talk to anything.
It's almost right there is the difference between Republican, Democrat, Green, any other political ideology, and libertarianism. Is I hate describing libertarianism as a political philosophy or a political ideology. It's not. It's a system of ethics and morals and lifestyle decisions that, and your culture that comes from those moral and ethical decisions guides your politics. But that's really what makes it different, is that libertarians who actually believe in the values of liberty believe it so deeply, it's how they live their lives. And that affects their friendships and relationships with others. Well, like, I know plenty of Democrats and Republicans that play card shops I play with, play Dungeons and Dragons, I met through work and everything else that, and they're friends with anybody. They don't care. Where I know a bunch of libertarians who can't stomach the idea of being friends with someone who wants to put them in a cage. So yeah, like having that community is absolutely critical to, if not your political success, at least your personal happiness.
Yeah, for sure. Your mental health, like obviously after 2020 and, you know, seeing all of your longtime friends just go totally crazy and haywire, and getting a little oasis of sanity is a godsend. Yeah.
Now, speaking of the Amish and people going crazy, haywire, one funny joke about Pennsylvanians and the Amish, a good friend of mine, Dan Bergman, actually told me once, he said, how come the Amish were not afraid of COVID?
Oh, I know. This was they didn't watch TV.
Exactly. That's it. Ding, ding, ding. The media is in the pocket of the state. The state will always try and oppress through fear, bad rationale.
There's a video of an interview of a gentleman, and this was his explanation for why they don't have COVID.
Yeah. So, well, we don't have television. Like, piss off. Great excuse. Now, Matt, anything you want to leave people with? Any final reminders, final remarks? Like, where can people follow you, learn more about what you're doing?
Bing, bang, bang. There you go. This is my website, matthackenberg.com. You can follow me on Twitter, at Matt Hackenberg. Yeah, we're, we're trying to get some stuff done, trying to get the word out. You know, any support anyone can give is great. Volunteers are always greatly appreciated. And, look, this is the, one of the things we can do, one of the few things we can do as libertarians is help spread that message and, get that mind virus planted in as many people as we can, and hopefully we'll sway the public consciousness over time and get going.
Hopefully it can be done. And everybody, again, matthackenberg.com. You can go check out Matt, look at his policies, his pitches, his proposals. Let him sell himself to you if you want to help out. And remember, the election's right around the corner. November 8th is not that far away. So there's this great button right on there. Most people's websites that says donate. If you want to help spread that word with what he's doing, you can hit the donate button, sign up, hear more from his campaign, hear more from him. And as always, the best way to support your candidates is just to share their content. Make sure that they can reach more people. That's something libertarians struggle to do. We have an echo chamber and we struggle to get out of it. It sucks. I know. I've found myself in it and found myself ridiculed by it. It's not a good place to be. It's not a fun place to be, especially when you're trying to change people's minds, win the issues of the day, and actually see liberty in your lifetimes fulfilled. So again, it's up on the screen. It's matthackenberg.com. Link in the description. Go check him out. Give him a visit. See what you can learn more. Matt, thanks so much for coming on. It's been a pleasure and a fantastic time. And just reminding everybody, hit that big like and subscribe button. Leave some comments. Let us know what you thought of the show, things you want to see covered in the future. And if you want to check out the documentary film, everything and the progress being made, the book's getting published next month and we're starting filming, gofundme.com/101reasons. There's supposed to be another S on that. I have a typo issue. Don't mind me. But you can help us get that project done here in New Hampshire as well. And we're not going to start filming until after the elections, because that's what really matters right now, is making sure liberty doesn't lose. So check it out. Give it a visit. Give it a like. Give it a subscribe. Make sure to tune in next week. And until next time, be free. Thank you for tuning in to another episode of Subversive. Make sure to like, subscribe, and turn on notifications to get alerted every time we go live on YouTube. And make sure to leave some comments and reviews on whatever platform you listen on to let me know what you thought of this episode. And a huge thanks and shout out to our sponsors and the awesome members of the Insurgency on Patreon. If you enjoyed this content, you can join the Insurgency on Patreon by following the links in the description for patreon.com/odomin. And if you can't catch the show live, you can always catch it the next day on YouTube, Odyssey, Anchor, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Breaker, CastBox, and wherever else you listen to your favorite podcasts every day. So until next time, everybody, be free.